Affairs Committee. It is Thursday.
Today's date.
February 17th.
Approximately
3:40 in the afternoon. Members who are present at this time. Oh, it's right here. There. Senator Elton, Senator Wagner, myself, Senator Terrio, and Senator Huggins. I'd like to take up Senate Bill 87. Initially, we have the prime sponsor here, Senator Bundy. If you would take the chair.
And if I might invite the staff to join me, Ms. Wickersham. Just to make you feel like it's the old days, well, Chairman Throat.
Watch it. You might not get your bill.
It's an inside joke. Chairman Terrio, committee members, thank you for addressing Senate Bill 87. For some of you, it's deja vu because this is a bill that went through the Senate last year. Seemed to lose its way in the other end of the hall. And I've been, it's been suggested that some of these issues have a gestation period that takes more than one session, and it's also been suggested that there are other people in the building that are viewing the bill more favorably or more realistically, I guess I would say, than they did last year. I am, for the record, Senator Bundy, Senate District P, and commend Senate Bill 87 to you. This bill changes our current law from a secondary seat law to a primary. In my mind, and perhaps an oversimplification, it simply allows us to enforce our current law. Currently, state statutes require that drivers and passengers wear seat belts while driving a motor vehicle. However, it's not as enforceable as it could be, some would say rather unenforceable, because currently, most thinking people buckle up, and they certainly buckle their children up before they drive. However, some of us need an occasional reminder, and police officers can't remind us to wear our seat belts under the current law because it's a secondary offense, and that means that you have to be stopped doing something else illegal, and then if you're not wearing your seat belt, you are subject to the law. Now, obviously, the law is not intended to collect a lot of fines. It's simply to encourage the wearing of seat belts. And this is incredibly important, I think, because it not only saves a lot of lives, it saves a lot of money. Research has shown that people who wear seat belts stay in better control of their car in emergency situations, less likely to skid into you or I, less likely to leave the road. And I had thought initially of collecting the names of all the victims that I've heard this past year who the troopers or the local police said would likely have survived had they been wearing a seatbelt. But I thought that was terribly unkind for their survivors and pretty intrusive. So I'm just going to say that there were a number of people that law enforcement officials felt would have survived their traffic accident had they been wearing a seatbelt. And in my mind, had we had a law like this law, well, they were more likely to wear their seatbelt. We had testimony from Fairbanks, I believe, last year, about the little shuffle that people do when they are at a stoplight, police officer pulls up behind them, they look in the rearview mirror, and then they kind of shuffle their seatbelt on. The reminder, and I know most of us surely would not drive without our children buckled up, and that is a rather serious offense. The amount of the fine for the driver not wearing a seatbelt is very small. But again, the notion is not to collect money. It's not a revenue generator. It is to save lives. And it is to save money because the impact of the severity of accidents that increases when people not wearing seat belts is an impact on our insurance rates. It's an impact on us as legislators, because those that either don't have insurance and are more severely injured, or those that do have insurance and their injuries take them beyond the limits of their insurance, they become then candidates for Medicaid, and we know how that has impacted our budget. The about 60 or 85% of all costs involved in motor vehicles are paid by society, either through emergency services, medical services, rehabilitation treatment, health and automobile insurance, or, as I said, programs like Medicaid. It has been projected by the National Highway Safety Institute that in Alaska alone, in 2002, it cost each and every one of us about $820 extra because people were not wearing seatbelts. And again, if we can do this, certainly the ultimate goal is to save lives. But we can also save our constituents money. I think we ought to consider it very strongly. There are other people who would like to speak to this bill. I will just close by pointing out that a survey done by the Alaska Injury Prevention Center found that about 87% of Alaskans would support a primary seatbelt law, and that, I said 87, it's 67. My expanded memory here is helping me out here. And Alaska does have the highest rate of unintentional injuries and deaths, and the majority of those are, of course, highway accidents. So with that, I'll say that the bill saves money and saves lives, and commend it to your consideration.
Thank you. Senator, can you tell me, the right now, if you get pulled over for another reason and you don't have your seatbelt on, you can be issued a citation for that. There's a fine associated with that. I don't know what it is. If this bill were to pass, would the fine now, that this could be a primary reason for being cited, be the same?
Same. Will not change. And the fine in municipalities are different than the state fine is $15. So it is, again, not a generator of revenue.
Senator Wagner?
Along with that, are there any points assessed to your driving record as far as failure to use the seatbelt?
I have to.
That,
not that I'm aware of. Our research, I don't believe, has shown that.
Go ahead, Senator.
One other question, Mr. Chairman. I'm a supporter of the bill, and I'm going to vote for it when it comes on the floor. But the one thing that bothers me, and this is going to be a continuous battle unless we do something about it, I can't for the life of me understand why it's we're so safety conscious about wearing seatbelts, yet every school bus in the state of Alaska continues to transport students day in and day out and not have seatbelts or require their use. And it comes down to one factor generally when you speak to school boards and administration groups about it. It's the dollar. Well, excuse me, but to put seatbelts in buses for children can't be that expensive. And this is going to give us some more federal money that we could do that with if it came down to that anyway, would it not?
This bill indeed will bring us some more highway safety money. And because I anticipated your question, I did do some research on that. And John Moffitt from the National Highway Safety Institute does discuss the cost, and to me that's not an adequate argument. But they also say because of the construction of the buses, they call it the egg crate theory, that the kids are with the high back seats and some padding, that they're less likely to be thrown from the vehicle than we are in a passenger vehicle. However, the NTSB is having discussions right now with the Highway Safety Transport Safety Association, and they are not in agreement, and I think there may be a federal recommendation coming down the pike here before long. I agree with you, the cost is not an adequate excuse.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Seeing none, thank you, Senator. We have a number of people to testify. Let's start first with Sergeant Julia Grimes with the Alaska State Troopers.
that?
I believe online. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, let's start with Kevin Quinlan, with the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the State Affairs Committee. My name is Kevin Quinlan. I'm Chief of Safety Advocacy at the National Transportation Safety Board. I want to thank you for allowing someone from outside to speak to the committee. I can assure you I'd rather be in Juneau than Washington, D.C. You have my written statement. Let me quickly cover a few points. You know of the NTSB from the Alaska Air 261 investigation, the Exxon Valdez. We're a very different federal agency. We investigate. We don't regulate. And we don't tell the states what to do. We ask you to do the right thing based on our investigations. We're known for our scientific integrity and our objectivity. You've heard that 90% of transportation fatalities occur on our highways. You heard, I heard Senator Bundy say seatbelts are the most effective defense against motor vehicle injuries. Let me just give you an example. They prevent ejection. In fatal crashes, 30% of occupants are ejected, and of those, 73% die. Belt use decreases with increasing crash severity. What that means is the highest risk drivers have the lowest belt use rates, and you can see that on page 4 of my testimony. Alcohol-impaired drivers have about a 17% use rate, and teen drivers have a 30% use rate. And just imagine the number of years of life saved by getting teen drivers and passengers to buckle up, and that's exactly what a primary belt law will do, and we have evidence from California and Michigan that it causes high-risk drivers to buckle up. The written testimony has some economic cost information. I think the bottom line is very clear. It's that primary belts save lives and reduce both governmental and non-governmental costs, and I think you can reasonably expect about a 10 percentage point increase in belt use among Alaskans if you pass this law. The survey that Senator Bundy cited is very similar to a national survey that was conducted, but one thing he didn't mention that was in the national survey is that 72% of Hispanics and 68% of African Americans support primary belt laws. The Safety Board, in its investigations, has issued some 12,000 recommendations to various entities, and we have a thing we call the most wanted list. And those are the recommendations that are most important because of their life-saving potential. Primary enforcement is on that list. It's the same list that has measures to prevent aircraft runway incursions and explosive fuel mixtures in aircraft fuel tanks, but it's more important because it has the potential to save more lives than any other measure on our list. It's a very high priority for the Safety Board. We feel it's good, compassionate public policy. It will save lives, not only this year, but every year. And I personally believe that it's the right thing to do. And, Mr. Chairman, we have investigated school bus crashes, so I can answer the question that was raised earlier. Thank you for your time, and I'd like to be mindful of the committee's time, so I'm going to stop right now and say thank you, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Can you tell me, does the national research indicate that that small children starting off in the safety seats, they get buckled in, they're in elementary school, my kids buckle in, they don't even think about it, and then they nag me to make sure that I buckle in as I'm pulling out of the garage. But then when they hit the teen years, is there a dip in usage?
Yes, there is. As a matter of fact, there's a gap that starts at about age 12. You're exactly correct. Parents who buckle up are more likely to have their children buckled up, and it's children in child safety seats. But something happens, and it could be we can speculate on the source. But around age 12, it starts to be uncool. And teenagers in particular do not wear their safety belts. I think it's last year you passed a graduated driver's license law. I think it's very important that we pass primary belt to get our teenagers to buckle up, because if they get a violation under graduated driver's licensing, they may have to do some driver improvement actions. So I think it's very important, and if you save five teen lives, you're probably saving 300 years of life, because they probably have a life expectancy of 60 or 70 more years, so it's a minimum. If you think in those terms, then it's really significant.
Yeah, well, I'm sure all the members of the committee were teens of exceptional intellect, but I have my son's just going to become 13, and as he enters the stupid years, is there a point where they come back out statistically and
I think
start buckling up again?
Yes, sir. It's about 25.
Long time to hold your breath.
That's called, Mr. Chairman, the era of invincibility.
I think that's right.
But overall, though, as states have moved to either mandatory laws or laws similar to the state of Alaska, is the overall trend continuing to grow that most people, sort of the societal norm of buckling up, continues to climb upward, or have we reached a plateau?
That's a difficult question to answer, and the reason is that for the last several years there have been enforcement mobilizations in both primary and secondary law states. And the secondary law states, including Alaska, over the last couple of years have seen a fairly substantial increase, and I think it's just enforcement related. The problem with that is it's very expensive, and it can't be sustained over a long period of time. However, if you had a primary law, that could be enforced episodically with good public information programs to remind people to buckle up, and you will achieve a much greater effect at a lower cost.
But clearly, even the secondary laws have had a positive impact. I mean, my own personal preference is that you would just let this continue to grow. I understand that the prime sponsor's motivations, though, and I just wondered if we're continuing to head in that direction as a nation, in particular here as the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying is I don't think that's going to happen absent these enforcement mobilizations that have been going on for the last several years. And as I said, they're very expensive. I don't think that there's going to be sufficient funds to continue those. So if that premise is correct, I think we will probably stagnate and maybe fall back, because that's the history of safety belt programs absent a primary safety belt law. You are correct in that the one state without a secondary belt law has about 15 to 20 percentage points less belt use than secondary states, and that's New Hampshire. They have about a 50% belt use, and I think the average in secondary states is around 70% or so.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions from committee members? Seeing none, we'll... Oh, Senator Huggins.
Sir, Senator Huggins here. If we pass the primary law, is there any impact on auto insurance?
Well, I represent an investigative agency. I can tell you what I think the insurance companies would say. They would say, we need to see the crash experience, and then we will file submissions to the State Insurance Commission based on those submissions. What they'll say privately is they know it works.
Let me ask it another way. There are 24 states that have primary, right?
There are 22 states that have primary.
Okay, 22. Of those 22, any of them receive a break on insurance?
Yes, North Carolina for sure. I know that.
that because they have some significant statistical positive based on the law?
I don't know the reason for that. I do know that they have a very aggressive insurance commission there.
Thank you.
Senator Wagner?
I was just going to say, in that case, for us to have our due diligence, I would think that correspondence, if this passes with our insurance commission, to have them address that and track and see after a year or two of this law being in effect, what the effect is on both care of surviving victims, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think he's probably right. It depends on how aggressive your insurance commission is as to whether they lower any insurance rates or not. I think, generally speaking, is what he said, is basically they don't lower insurance rates, and if you don't do something with the commission, then I think the people would deserve that if they use their seatbelts more. So maybe that's what we need to track, too.
Senator Elton?
I was just going to add, and I think the question that Senator Huggins asked is a very important question, because it's in many other jurisdictions, insurance costs aren't based on accident history. In some cases, they're based on your credit history, which has absolutely no nexus at all to incidents. So it's an interesting question.
Okay, if there are no further questions, we'll go next to Walt Monaghan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the panel. I want to again reaffirm my support for Senate Bill 87. I think that a primary seatbelt law would be very effective in maintaining a healthy lifestyle in regards to all walks of life, motoring public, most especially, of course. I submitted a letter of support, and I provided some information for the packet earlier. But I can tell you that APD, along with other law enforcement agencies, have continued to try to inform our citizens about the use of seatbelts and the importance of them, even to include in our press releases when we describe fatality accidents, whether the victims in this case were wearing or not wearing seatbelts. A poignant story most recently was up on Hillside, where there was a family, the vehicle rolled over, the mother was not wearing a seatbelt and was ejected and subsequently killed. However, her children were buckled in safely, and they survived, obviously. And these kind of stories really, I think, are very poignant in so many other aspects and besides money, besides insurance. We're talking, obviously, about families, and in this case, children, for example, who will only have a memory of a mother. We routinely also will use our school resource officers to conduct blitzes, if you will, on watching vehicles drive up, and where they do at some points often merely just remind people that they should be wearing seatbelts versus citations. The comment made earlier about the shuffling of drivers putting their seatbelt on when they see a marked unit, well, I can tell you, in my experience throughout the years, driving around in marked and unmarked units, if people suspect that we're a police officer, I've seen a lot of that at intersections or parking lots, or I get a knowing smile from somebody who sheepishly will reach down and buckle up their seatbelt. So I know that realistically people know what's better for them in that. I support that.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Bundy.
Thank you. The committee probably realizes that this is the Anchorage Chief of Police who's testifying. Walt, one of the concerns that I hear from some in the public is that your department and others in the state would use this as a kind of a search and destroy mission, if you will, that it's a thinly veiled excuse for you to be out stopping people, trying to arrest them for other related problems. Could you address that concern?
Sure. I could tell you that there are numerous other violations that are much more readily visible and more explainable if, in fact, we were to try to do those kind of things. the get-go. I mean, driving down the road, you see that strap extending from the doorpost over to the driver's shoulder. You're not going to, unless you're looking for it, and it's sometimes difficult to see at night, you're not going to be able to pick that off at an instant. However, you can see burnt-out taillights, obscured license plate light, or license plates, cracked windshields, any number of things. There's literally hundreds of laws already on the books that if I wanted to go on a search and destroy thing, which we don't, but if we wanted to, the seatbelts would not be the one that would be most easily and recognizable to make a legal traffic stop.
Okay, thank you.
But can you tell me, this is Senator Terrio, because of that, you know, the taillight is either burned out or it's not, or the license plate is covered with snow or it's not, or you've got them on this, your radar gun at a certain speed or not. But because they can do the shrug and buckle up as they're pulling over, how do you ever get them on a seatbelt violation?
It's usually, right now, it is obviously a secondary violation. So I pull you over for your taillight. I walk up and I see you now reaching down and buckling up, and I know you're in violation. Of course, children are a different matter, under 16, and they are required to have it. And if you drive by and you see a kid standing up in the back seat or roaming around in the back seat, then you know they're not secured, and that's enough stop or enough reason for a stop right then and there. I can tell you that everybody's absolutely right that this is not a generational or money generational kind of thing. Our fines here in Anchorage for that, for anybody who is 16 or older, is it's a $60 fine. It carries no points. But because we all value children, any child or any passenger under the age of 16, if we do see something like that, that does carry a 2-point and a $200 fine up here. So we all can see the value of protecting our young ones. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts, every parent here would agree that, well, I meant to, or I would, and I like the story I mentioned in regards to the hillside. I mean, the mother was obviously concerned enough that she buckled her children in. Had she buckled herself in, they'd still be a united family.
But I guess I still have the question. I go into Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. As I pull up to the gate, I have to get out my ID and show the guard. I can't get my ID. I can't get my wallet out of my pocket with my seatbelt on. If I get pulled over by a trooper, the first thing the trooper wants to see is my registration and my driver's license. So wouldn't I be able to always cover myself by saying, well, officer, I just took my seatbelt off to get my wallet, and here's my ID?
Well, let me tell you a little trick about police officers, and every other officer who's listening would understand this. When I get out of my car, as I walk up to your car, because traffic stops are inherently one of the most dangerous things that police officers do. More cops die on traffic stops and domestic violence calls than any other reason. So when I get out of my car and I'm walking up to you on your car, I'm watching you. And if I see you unsnap your seatbelt to reach over to get your in preparation for your wallet, I'm already aware that you had it on. If you didn't have it on, and I now reach, I'm watching your arms, I'm watching your body motions, because I don't want to get up there and set up a wallet, me the gun. So we watch these things. Perhaps that's not well clear to non-law enforcement personnel, but we teach it as officer safety.
What degree of success, though, for a person that contests the ticket and goes and says, Your Honor, you know, I was getting my wallet out, or I got my wallet out as I, pulled over to the curb, so I was ready for the officer. Or is the traffic court going to routinely toss those, do you suspect?
Actually, I can't speak for the magistrates, but I can tell you that that's the case in every other thing, where I say you were speeding, you say you were not, whether you ran the stop sign or not. Those things, we'll let the court decide. And even if I had pulled you over and you snuck by and you prevailed in court, I think the next time you were out there driving around, you probably would still think, I don't want to let lightning I don't want to feel lucky twice, so I will wear my seatbelt. So I still think it's a good learning process, even if I lose it in court.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator Bundy.
And we'll never write enough laws to keep all people who want to avoid obeying the law from finding some loophole. But I think if we take just an average person's behavior and say, this is the law, and I will, whether I want to debate it or not, I'll generally abide by the law. There are a certain percentage that no matter what the law is, they're not going to abide by it. But for the vast majority, the big middle of the population, if there's a law that says it's primary offense to wear a seatbelt, they're more inclined to obey the law than find a way around the law. In spite of Alaska's libertarian bent, I think there's still the majority of them would rather obey the law than not.
And if I can add one more thing, in regards to those, before the kids go into the I don't want to mess my hair or wrinkle my shirt mode and try not to wear seatbelts, up until that point, your children will get after you, as they do me. If I back out of the garage and I haven't buckled my seatbelt up, my kids, when they were smaller, would turn around and say, Dad, you're a cop. You need to put your seatbelt on. So the kids are aware of it.
Okay, thank you. We'll go next to Dave Parker. And Mr. Parker, were you signed up for Senate Bill 87 or Senate Bill 54?
Yeah, it was Senate Bill 54 that I was speaking
okay,
to.
We'll get to that next.
Okay.
We'll go to Al Story then.
Hear me?
Go ahead.
Yeah, my name's Al Story, and for the record, I'm a captain of the Alaska State Troopers. I work on Colonel Julia Grimes' staff here at headquarters. Of course, she's the director of the troopers. I wanted to speak just briefly, because I know you're on a time constraint, that certainly Department of Public Safety strongly supports this bill. Excited to see it back before the legislators again this year. We think that it has a lot of viability, and pleased to see it passed into law. You know, everything that can be said about the seatbelt saving lives and preventing injury has been said. I think Senator Bundy referred to the accident or the injury prevention study on what it cost society for these injuries, and that's an excellent study and does an excellent job of articulating the long-range cost of people not wearing their seatbelt, not just the death of people, but people that are seriously injured and what it costs to deal with them for the rest of their lives. So there's not much more that I can add other than it seems like a common-sense approach to vehicle safety. We do many things to try to protect our people from cigarettes and drugs and alcohol, and this just seems like such a common-sense approach that we can protect a fair number of people from long-term injuries or death. If I might add, that Senator Bundy did refer to a number of people that have been killed, and I've kept track of that since last session, just informally here at my desk, and I have those names, and I have the circumstances where they were ejected from vehicles, neither seriously injured or... See the names, you can see their ages, you can see the circumstances, it really rings home. Those could have saved a large number of these people. Jokingly, somebody said a little while ago that, you know, that time between 13 and 25 when our breath to hope that our... That, well, I think this bill would allow us to breathe a little bit easier if we... wearing their seatbelts when they leave the house. So, certainly available for any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, we'll go next to Don Smith in Anchorage.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Don Smith. As a feedback, sorry about the feedback.
Don, we're getting a lot of feedback here.
I just pressed the button.
Try again.
I'm trying. try and move away from the speaker a little bit here. Hopefully it'll go away. Can you hear me okay now?
That's a lot better. We don't have a howl, at least.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Don Smith, and I'm the administrator of the Alaska Highway Safety Office in Juneau. I'm the governor's representative for highway safety in Alaska. Try not to cover any points that have already been made, but I would like to point out that in the past 40 years, since 1964, 3,782 Alaskans have died on Alaska's highways. In this past year where we kept records, 99 Alaskans died in highway crashes, and roughly 50 of those deaths occurred and the individuals were not wearing a seatbelt. Currently, our observational surveys show that 77% of all drivers are wearing seatbelts while they're driving on Alaska's highways. Statistics indicate that states that move from secondary status to primary will see their seatbelt use increase by 10 to 12%, which would put us in the range of 87 to 89% belt usage. I would like to cite an example of an accident that occurred in Alaska this past year. And it occurred in Juneau on Halloween Day. Three teenagers driving in a Ford 150 pickup truck, driven by a boy that was 19 years old, just graduated the year before from high school, and two 17-year-old girls. The truck was driving at approximately 90 miles an hour at mile 32 of the North Highway out of Juneau. Went out of control. The boy attempted to bring it into control, got it down to about 75 miles an hour when he impacted with a rock cliff. He was ejected, 19 years of age, and died. The passenger, a girl that was 17 years old, was also ejected and was taken to Seattle for treatment, unconscious and on life support. And the third passenger, another 17-year-old girl, was partially ejected and was paralyzed from the neck down. I can't say, or no one I'm sure could say that these kids would have been alive today, but my chances are, had they been buckled, that would not have occurred. Everything that needs to be said, I think, has been said. I just urge passage of this bill, and thank you for your time.
Okay, next let's go to Fairbanks, Sergeant Dan Wellborn.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I'm kind of a late addition here. I apologize for, I wish I would have known about this a little bit earlier, otherwise I'd have been a little bit better prepared. The director and deputy chief wanted to attend. They couldn't. They asked me to come on down, and I'm glad I did. I've testified in the past on this particular bill. Fairbanks Police Department is a big supporter of seatbelts. We generally take part in almost every click it or ticket campaign. We do have overtime on a regular basis throughout the year. My interest in traffic safety goes back about 12 and a half years now. I'm the FARS rep for our department, fatal accident reporting. I'm also an accident investigator. I'm a child safety technician, commercial motor vehicle inspector, so I kind of have a hand in a lot of the traffic safety type issues. I won't go into too much. It sounds like everybody's done a pretty good job of explaining everything from what I've heard up to this point. However, I would like to mention that just the number of fatalities I've been on over the years, the ones I've been to and I've investigated, I can tell you that quite a few of those would have been prevented. We probably could have downgraded some of those fatalities to injury accidents or no injury at all had there been a seatbelt used. And we're talking about some pretty severe accidents, pretty grotesque as far as what I've been to and what I've seen. I know that the chief from APD earlier had testified as far as officer observations in the courtroom. I can tell you from my experience from enforcing seatbelts and being in the courtroom on a daily basis, even to this day, that the courts do rely heavily on officer testimony and observation. The chief was right on when he says officers before they even approach that vehicle, they know before that vehicle even stops, before they're stopped. They can see if there's a seatbelt violation or not. That's part of our training. We don't get too much. I haven't heard too much opposition in the Fairbanks area to seatbelts. I know our current seatbelt rate is right there in the mid-60 percent. It was a couple of years back, and I think we've raised that all the way up to, I believe, the last time I checked, it was right at about 79%, I want to say. I've seen it make a big difference. I've been part of the pre- and post-surveys. I've been a part of that enforcement, and I'm proud to say I have been a part of that enforcement. So more than anything else, I just wanted to give the support from the Fairbanks Police Department and let you all know that we do support seatbelts, and they are important.
Thank you. We'll go next to Kodiak. We have Don Roberts.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Roberts. I'm 264 Lilly Drive. I find normally I'm one of those, well, first of all, let me tell you, I support Senate Bill 87, and normally I'm one of those folks that kind of object to the government's heavy-handedness. I object to all kinds of encroachments on civil liberties. And, you know, this is not one of those times. I'm critical of a lot of things, but this is one of the smarter things that comes out. This is a small encroachment that has large effect. It's not a victimless crime. The victims are the families and the people that are affected by a person's death and disability. I'd like to add also that I'm a disability rights advocate. The one thing I really don't need is more people with traumatic brain injury and paralysis and mental illness as a result of these things. I don't have a written testimony. Normally I do. But this is... I just can't see why anybody intelligent would object to this. Just to wear a seatbelt to save lives and keep people healthy is just a smart thing to me. And I'm actually on the other side of the aisle for this one.
Thank you.
That's really all I have to say.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Seeing none, we'll go back to Anchorage, Joan Diamond.
Hi, this is Joan Diamond. I am speaking for the Municipal Department of Health and Human Services. I have spoken previously when the primary seatbelt was being considered. It is a high priority again for Anchorage, and I did send a letter from the Department of Health stating many of the reasons that we support it, and I don't want to go into them again because most of the people that have spoken have already given an eloquent explanation. For the city of Anchorage, you know, we see two things. One, there's no question if we can reduce injuries, we're going to reduce health care costs. And the second, that we do feel in our struggle to reduce drinking and driving, the seatbelt law will have some impact on reducing the number of people that do drink to intoxication and drive. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have anybody else on teleconference that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 87? If not, we're going to go to those people here in Juneau. First on the list, Cindy Cashin.
Good afternoon. I'm Cindy Cashin, and I'm the executive director of the MAD Juneau chapter. I'm here today representing the MAD Alaska chapters. Thank you for giving us the time to speak in support of Senate Bill 87. We appreciate Senator Bundy for coming forth again and bringing this bill, and we hope it'll be successful this time. MAD supports primary seatbelt because it's our best defense against a drunk driver. And I think everyone else before me has already spoken why we support it, so I will leave it at that.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you. Kathy McLaren?
Thank you, Mr. Senator. I'm with the EMS, Kathy McLaren, I'm the EMS unit manager. I'm with Section of Community Health and Emergency Medical Services, and we support Senate Bill 87. In 2002, there were 36,830 Alaskans involved in car, truck, and bus crashes. According to the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, unbelted occupants in motor vehicle crashes were 17 times more likely to die than belted occupants and 6 times more likely to sustain a major injury. 82% of belted occupants walked away from their crashes compared with 63% of unbelted occupants. The Alaska Trauma Registry reports that unbelted crash victims are more likely to sustain a serious brain injury. Almost 100 new brain-injured Alaskans per year. Unbelted crash victims are also more likely to be discharged from hospital with permanent disability, about 30 cases a year. Alaska's seatbelt wear rate was estimated to be between 77% in previous testimony and a 2003 observational study. That's a very good rate and probably as high as it will go without a primary enforcement law. It's the remaining 21% of the people who are incurring the greatest cost to Alaska through uninsured medical care and hospital charges billed to Medicaid for these serious injuries. These two groups make up 31% of the patients hospitalized for crash injuries. If half of them buckled up, the NTSB estimates that the savings in Alaska would be as much as $10 million per year. This represents medical care, rehabilitation costs, lost productivity, and funeral expenses. And most important, five fatalities could be prevented, as well as 58 serious injuries prevented each year. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? And finally, I have Martha Moore. Okay. Do we have anybody else, either on teleconference or here in Juneau, on Senate Bill 87? Now, Senator Bundy, a question for you. Last year, as the bill wound through the system, you ended up with some kind of a rural exemption over on the House side. Would you make a comment on that?
I'm going to leave that to the wisdom of the House. If that's not a contradiction of terms.
In other words, no comment.
Yes.
Do we have questions for the prime sponsor? I mean, the wording of the bill is not subject to a lot of interpretation, so we either repeal it or we don't. So what is the will of the committee? Senator Wagner.
I'd move Senate Bill number 87 with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. Is there objection? Seeing none, the bill will move to the next committee of referral.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And knowing and near and dear to this committee's heart, there are 5-0 fiscal notes.
Note that.
We next will take up Senate Bill 54. Senator Dyson has asked that for an opportunity to introduce his bill today, but has asked that the committee not take any final action, and then we will hopefully have time to get to Senate Bill 90. Welcome, and if you would introduce the concept embodied in Senate Bill 54.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing the bill. In this, during the interim, a friend of mine who does investigate lots of sex crimes in South Central Alaska collared me and said, "Need a little help in the statutes. Our present law allows for a victim to get a restraining order for domestic violence and for stalking, but it doesn't specifically mention that you can get a restraining order if you've been a victim of sexual assault." And so what SB 54 does is adds sexual assault to the basis on which a magistrate or a judge can grant a restraining order. Subsequently, we found that some judges do grant a restraining order to a victim of sexual assault, but it's not clear in the statute, and several have refused. So we are trying to close that loophole and make it clear to judges that they have the authority when they choose to grant a restraining order to a victim of sexual assault. Many other jurisdictions do this, and so what we're trying to do here. And then subsequently, we asked Ledge Legal to draft the bill for us, and they chose, for their own reasons, to almost exactly replicate the language from the domestic violence restraining orders, and that induced a whole lot of stuff that we hadn't anticipated in terms of training and so on and so forth. Now we hear from some folks that we know in the Department of Law, it would probably have been a lot cleaner if we had just replicated the language in existing statutes that has to do with stalking. So we are going to ask you to hold this bill and give us a few days to get a committee substitute drafted that has significantly simpler language, and I hope we'll have the agreement of the Department of Law, and public safety, I think, has some concerns as well. So sorry that it's late coming. We would have been delighted to have our critics show up sooner as well. Wish that we had done a better job, but I think we will have an excellent product when you allow us to bring this back before you.
Senator Dyson, in dealing with restraining orders and whatnot, I've gotten some criticism over the past couple of years that while the legislature has taken steps that are well-intentioned, they haven't always been mindful of the unintended consequences, and primarily on how something that's well-intended in the fray that is litigation, sometimes those things can be used as tools. In a way that the legislature is not intended. And I'm just wondering if you've had any interaction with anybody that's cautioned you on that front with this piece of legislation, whether you've thought of those, worked through those things. I'm just trying to be more mindful.
Yeah, so I think, Mr. Chairman, exactly what you're speaking to is when we, I think even last year, made some change that has to do with custody, and if in a custody dispute, if one of the partners in the custody dispute has had a DV charge, that can be used against them in the custody hearing. And I understand that some custody divorce attorneys have been encouraging their clients to hustle out and file a DV charge and or try to get a restraining order when there may be no grounds at all, but in order to tilt the next process, which is the custody hearings. And I had
that's the exact issue, and boy, did I get an earful. So I just want to know if you've anticipated that and figured a way to deal with that.
No, but with your indulgence, we'll take this little break here and see if there's maybe the Department of Law and some of these folks can help us, and we might be able to, under the same title, to help rectify the unintended consequences of our earlier actions. I appreciate that, that suggestion. And there's some folks here in the room that know a lot more about this than me and may be able to help us.
Okay. Thank you. If you want to just stay there, we've got Dave Porter on teleconference. Mr. Porter, or Parker, excuse me.
Yeah, this is Sergeant Dave Parker. I'm the supervisor of the Anchorage Police Department Special Victims Unit. And we're the folks who are involved in the actual investigation of sexual assault here in Anchorage. We handle all victims age 16 and over. I really appreciate the legislature's efforts and the strong laws that they have adopted that protect victims of domestic violence and of stalking. And what Senator Dyson's bill would do would be enable us to use the same kind of strong laws to protect the victims of sexual assault. The problem that we have faced is that, as Senator Dyson mentioned, judges don't have real clear direction on this. And it came to light about a year ago when one of my detectives took a sexual assault victim, a woman who had been sexually assaulted by her neighbor, took her down to the courthouse to get a protective order, and we were shocked to find that the judge didn't feel like he could issue that order since rape was not a consensual sexual act. Had there been a dating relationship, had they had consensual sex previously, then a protective order could have been issued, but in this situation, because it was not consensual, there was no protective order issued. I think we all understand what a tremendously traumatic event sexual assault is, and that no victim should be re-victimized by unwanted contact with their perpetrator. And this bill, I believe, in whatever final form it comes out in, would extend the same kind of legal protection to sexual assault victims as DV and stalking victims have now. And especially important to that would be the ability of law enforcement to arrest people who broke the protective order or who disobeyed the protective order without warrant, as we do now with domestic violence and with stalking. So I really would like to speak in favor of this bill, and I believe it would bring a tremendous degree of protection to our sexual assault victims.
Thank you. Do committee members have questions? Senator Wagner.
I just want to know if you can answer the question why the judge, did he not give the protection to the victim because the person hadn't been convicted of the crime yet at that time? Or what is going through a judge's mind when he refuses to give that protective order?
In that particular case, the woman went down with the detective after the investigation had begun. It had not been concluded yet by an arrest or a conviction. For domestic violence and for the stalking restraining orders, the level of proof required is not beyond a reasonable doubt like it would be for a conviction, but instead it is a probable cause. And the judge has to have probable cause to issue that order. The problem with this judge issuing that order in that specific instance and in all the other instances that we've had that are similar to that was that they did not feel like there had been either a domestic relationship or a dating relationship and stalking had not yet occurred. Therefore, they didn't feel like the laws presently covered sufficiently the situation where a person had been sexually assaulted. It didn't cover them sufficiently to issue those kinds of orders. This would just expand the categories of individuals who can't obtain those orders by one category, that being sexual assault victims.
Further questions? Seeing none, do we have anybody else on teleconference on Senate Bill 54? Hearing none, do we have any other individuals here in Juneau that wish to testify? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, somebody I've really learned to appreciate. Dean Dwinelli is here and had lots of experience, and I wonder if Dean might be able to shed some light on the issue that you and I are concerned about.
We'll see how quickly he thinks on his feet.
Very quickly in the past.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Guinelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I've learned over the years that there's a certain period of time in any hearing when I should escape and leave quickly before I'm noticed. But didn't follow that, my own advice. I think the question you asked about abuse of process, in essence, is in a divorce situation, child custody situation, I think is really a difficult one to get our hands around. Divorces, and particularly those where there is contested child custody, become very emotional, at times very acrimonious, and as Senator Dyson indicated, I think, when one person contacts a lawyer and they look around for any advantage that they might advise their client about a alleged domestic violence incident is something that that is perhaps a viable option. I think that what we probably right now need to depend on is the good judgment of judges to kind of sort out these things. Unfortunately, sometimes judges don't know that next week there's going to be a child custody action filed, and What I'm uncertain of, I haven't looked at the court forms for a while, but whether they ask about the whether there are pending other civil actions, custody disputes, that sort of thing going on. Maybe Mr. Wolver knows, but to the extent that judges can find out about the entire situation, I think they would be much better able to render a judgment as to whether it's particularly appropriate in that case to issue a domestic violence protective order. On the other hand, there are certainly divorces and child custody battles where there has also been domestic violence, so where the domestic violence protective order is really appropriate. And I think it's a difficult job for the judges to sort out when it's appropriate and when it's not. So I appreciate Senator Dyson's confidence in our ability to solve this, but I think it's a difficult situation.
Anytime you're dealing with family law, it's difficult to write laws to take into consideration all the ramifications. Senator Elton had a question.
I'm in a learning mode now, Dean. I mean, I'm assuming that if, in fact, an attorney did encourage an abusive process, as you called it, I mean, there must be a legal sanction and a professional sanction, and I would hope that in those cases, both would be pursued vigorously, because, I mean, that just turns the justice system upside down.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, sure. I mean, there are professional sanctions available for that kind of abusive process. I think as a practical matter, it's very difficult to find out that use of that available remedy was as a direct result of your attorney advising you to do it, and that when the attorney gave that advice, that the attorney knew that it wasn't justified. Those are very difficult things to sort out, and so I think as a practical matter, some of those sanctions, may not be available. I mean, certainly, if we find out about it, they can be pursued.
And can you think of instances where that's been pursued? Because that would be very difficult. I mean, it's almost to the point. One of the conversations that I had, that if an attorney doesn't go through the questioning, was there abuse, were there situations where you were fearful, they're almost subject to malpractice because they didn't ask those things, and they're not necessarily prompting their client to make an unfair allegation, but it's a difficult situation to tell exactly who's correctly availing themselves of the law and who's using the law as a tool.
Senator, I think that a smart attorney might very well say, well, if this in fact happened to you, then this remedy would be available to you, and as a consequence of that, we would of course bring that to the judge's attention in the child custody action, and that action might be more in your favor. So, in other words, the lawyer's kind of leaving it up to the client to pursue that. And because a lawyer is not required in pursuing a domestic violence restraining order, the lawyer who's representing in the child custody action or divorce action may not even be in court or anywhere nearby. So I think, as I said, as a practical matter, it's very difficult to sort those out. I mean, I've heard anecdotally that this has happened, but nothing that we can really, and certainly from a criminal standpoint, it's not really a crime to do that. I mean, it's a Alaska Bar Association, grievance process that would have to proceed.
The way the law is currently written, though, the mere allegation, is it just the allegation of domestic violence that triggers the custody consequence? Case of it may advantage, it's a slam dunk, it's a done deal, isn't it?
Senator, I'm not, I'd have to look at the exact language of it. I think that, to the extent that a judge in a custody proceeding hears evidence that there was domestic violence, I think that's something that weighs heavily in that judge's mind, because domestic violence has been shown to have a particularly pernicious effect on children and the way they ultimately develop. So they're very concerned about that, and so I would think that if there is evidence of it, that that's something they consider. The question is whether the mere fact that a domestic violence order was obtained is enough evidence to sway a judge in a child custody proceeding, or whether there's going to have to be a little bit more than that. And that's, I mean, not practicing in that area, I don't.
Okay, Senator Dyson, do you want to?
Yeah.
First of all, any more questions for Dean? Okay, why don't you scoot your chair over so we can pick you up on the microphone.
Sergeant Parker, are you still online?
Yes, I am.
Dave, do you find yourself in a situation where you're seeking a restraining order before charges have been filed?
Yes, and also there are situations where we cannot prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's certainly evident to the probable cause level that a sexual assault has occurred. And in those situations, a restraining order would be the only protection that a victim could have.
Yeah, so I was just looking at the code here, and I was wondering if we could start to solve this problem by requiring that if you're going to get a restraining order, you'd have to file charges. And certainly a sexual assault is always criminal and might be civil as well, but they're always criminal. And you're saying that, no, you need the restraining order before you've made the case sufficiently to get to file charges and look for a warrant.
Yes, right? That's correct. And it's actually very similar to the domestic violence situation. Often we find ourselves with domestic violence unable to prefer charges, but yet there is enough evidence for a judge to issue a domestic violence order.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And I see that Karen Robinson had something to add to the discussion here before we move on to the next bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll be very brief. And again, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here representing the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And to start, definitely the network is in support of Senator Dyson's bill and the direction. We chose not to testify today because we would like to see some changes and work with him first, maybe looking at it toward the stalking laws. But we would obviously be very disheartened to see the domestic violence protective order laws changed. And we'll work with the sponsor and the rest of you to get you some information. There's definitely been some work and studies done on custody disputes and domestic violence. And I think it's important to remember that it's repeated domestic violence. I mean, these situations where I think there's probably very few cases that a woman walks into a lawyer's office to get a divorce where there hasn't already been a long history of domestic violence, a long history of getting protective orders. And that's important that you remember that. And so, but we'll get you some information so that can help you make decisions. But definitely when it's looking at stranger sexual assault and looking at ways to assist those victims, we're in support of working with the Senator on moving that direction.
And Karen, just to sort of wrap things up today, how is that used? I don't remember the wording from the bill last year, I think it was. How is the allegation of domestic violence, what does it trigger, and how immediate does it trigger it in the custody hearing? Is it just an automatic, if there is a history or current allegation of domestic violence, you don't get custody at all? There's no question. You're out of the picture.
If it's okay, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that answer can be answered by Terry Robinson, who is here. Is that something you could answer? You'll have to come up here real quickly. She is the legal advocate for the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and even though I've worked in this field for a long time, this is new being back and working exactly on the law. So I'll let Terry.
Hi, and my name is Carrie Robinson, and I'm the attorney with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and I direct our legal advocacy project. And to answer your question, it's a presumption, so it can be overcome by the other side, you know, showing their own evidence. And it's not just one act, it has to be repeated. So, yeah.
Well, perhaps if we could just get a little information on what type of evidence would, you know, overcome that presumption just before we bring it back up for a hearing next time.
Sure, and you know, and I would also, we'd be happy, we have a lot of materials that we've provided and put together on that new presumption law, and I could provide that to the committee.
And in the bill that went through last year, was that the full scope of the bill, or was there a larger package that was one part of?
The presumption of custody? You know, I wasn't involved in the legislative end, but...
Okay, do we have any further testimony on Senate Bill 54? Seeing none, we will be scheduling this sometime when Senator Dyson indicates that he's prepared for that.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
To Senate Bill 90. We have Senator Huggins, member of the committee, is the prime sponsor. So, Senator, if you would like to introduce the issue to us.
Yes. This is a bill, an act relating to Alaska Territorial Guard. Quite frankly, there's a young, broad-shouldered gentleman here that does heavy lifting on this particular bill. Recently graduated from high school. Had a couple of medical setbacks, but has researched this, and I can only imagine if at this point in life, once upon a time, I couldn't find where the state legislature was, much less to present it. So, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Ryan Moore speak on behalf of the bill.
Sure. Mr. Moore, can you come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ryan Moore, and I'm legislative staff with Senator Huggins. I just want to give you a brief history on the Alaska Territorial Guard. Right after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese seized the islands of Attu and Kiska and bombed Dutch Harbor. After this happened, Governor Ernest Gruening was assigned two military aides to assist him in forming the Alaska Territorial Guard. The first one was Captain Carl Schneebner, and he was responsible for organizing the guard in the interior, and the second being Major Marvin Muktuk Marston, and he was designated to organize the guard on the Bering and the Arctic coasts. These two men's combined efforts resulted in 6,500 predominantly Alaska Native men signing up to protect the territory and the country. The Alaska Territorial Guard was disbanded in 1947, though some after they were disbanded, they were included in the regular Alaska National Guard as scout battalions. Last year, on October 18th, the first members of the Alaska Territorial Guard were recognized as veterans by the United States Army, and that is why October 18th was decided to be the day for Alaska Territorial Guard Day. I'd like to thank you for hearing my testimony. I'm open to any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Senator Wagner?
I just have an observation. I read through this. I was fascinated reading the work that you did on this, and congratulate you. It's very interesting.
Senator Huggins?
Mr. Chair, to continue on as I was saying about Ryan, I mean, he's done lots of research on this to include the archives. This is a continuation of a saga which I bumped into a year plus ago. And essentially, this group of 6,500 people, for the most part, had gone unrecognized by our state, by our nation, whereby we had recognized other countries' soldiers that had served in our military and provided them with discharge certificates. And what we're talking about here is there's less than 300 of the people that are left alive that served. One of them's Carl Moses, was in the Territorial Guard. So it's not about money. The remainder of their families will be recognized, and there may be a headstone, flags, and a few things like that. It's minimal in that respect. But I guarantee you, you go to any village, and you mention Alaska Territorial Guard, and ears will perk up. Heads will fly up, and they'll start talking about their uncles and their grandfathers and on and on and on. It is a big thing. And I'm just proud of the fact that we had the privilege of looking at this, and it's my privilege that Ryan has uncovered a bunch of these sorts of things. Our nation is finally coming to grips, and I'm sad that it's taken us 60 years, but I'm proud of the fact that we've done it.
Senator, how... How wedded are you to Section 1, the findings? Could that be just a letter of intent that went along with the bill?
Yes. No, there's no lockstep aspect of anything in here. The intent, quite frankly, when Ryan was doing this, and he and I visited a little bit, but he essentially did it himself, was to make sure that the essence of why we were doing it was captured a little bit so that it wasn't too sterile that 60 years from now, people didn't understand what this was all about. That was really the essence.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it is the uncodified section of the law, so the two sections would be broke apart and appear in the statutes
right.
in completely different books. And I, over my tenure here, have continually annoyed people by stripping out finding sections.
Right, no, I understand.
And would you be opposed to just removing that and just having a letter of intent that would,
no,
that
no,
would
that's
be
fine.
In the record?
That's fine. But I will defer to Ryan if he has any strong feelings in that respect, since he's the author.
Well, first of all, Senator Elton.
Well, generally, Mr. Chair, I agree with you. But I think that the points that were made by the sponsor, I do think that even for those of us who have been in the state for a long, long time, I mean, memories grow vague, other things happen. And I even feel awkward saying that I disagree with you this time, because I think most of the time findings and intent provide clutter. But I guess I am less amenable to taking it out than the sponsor might be, and I find that kind of an awkward situation. So I'm just putting my feelings on record. I mean, in this instance, I think a finding in law that tells why we're doing this makes sense to me.
Senator, I guess, you know, to have it appear in the statute book, to me, there just needs to be a compelling reason. And like I said, this person that looks this up in the statute, they're not even going to necessarily know that it exists somewhere in some uncodified section. If they wanted to get the background and the research, in fact, I would think they would go to the library to get the whole history. I mean, get all these articles that have been gathered up. Rather than, you know, just, they won't even know to go to the uncodified section.
Mr. Chair, 99 times out of 100, I'd be nodding my head yes.
Ryan, do you have a comment?
Oh, no.
Well, Senator Huggins, I would prefer it that way, to have a letter of intent, and it certainly will work with your staff, and I don't think there would be any problem with it. So at this time, I would move this an amendment.
And at this time, I would not object, you know, because the sponsor is agreeing with you. This one is just different for me, so.
Well, I would move an amendment that Section 1 be dropped from the bill, and it would be my intent to work with the sponsor to have a letter of intent that follows along and could perhaps even contain a little bit more, could be a little bit more expansive and contain some more of this information that points out exactly why it's being done. Is there objection to the motion?
I have no objection.
Seeing none, that will pass. And that brings us to take a quick look. We got a zero fiscal note. And so what would be the will of the committee? Senator Wagner.
I would move Senate Bill number 90 with attached fiscal note and individual recommendations as amended.
Okay. There's no objection. Motion to move the bill as amended with the individual recommendations passes the committee. It will now go up to, it just goes to State Affairs. So we'll prepare to go to Rules Committee then, if possible action on the floor, and we are adjourned for the day. But before we do adjourn, let's see. Senator Elton, under the, all you have to do is ask. We have scheduled the ballot propositions bill for next week, and also the public health is on the schedule for next week. So we'll have five.
Those are minority bill.
One's a governor's bill. One's a governor's bill.
And the normal course of action, the way I'd like to work the committee is quite often, unless it's something fairly concise, we'll have a hearing and have committee action later. So no promise that anything scheduled next week will pass, but we'll hear it and see what work needs to be done on the bill.
Oh, come on now. If the bill gets to the floor, it passes. If the bill gets to the committee, it ought to pass.
So we're adjourned.
They don't pass. I almost...